International Diplomatic Student Association is Hungary-based student organization for university students interested in political science, multilateral treaties, and intergovernmental relations. IDSA podcast aims to educate its listeners on career opportunities to university students in Hungary, opening their minds to pressing social and geopolitical issues. The podcast is recorded with the support of EPR Radio.
Welcome everyone to the second season of the IDSA podcast. My name is Dóra Tóth and my co-host is Petra Szijjártó. In today's podcast, we will discuss an international theory called neo-medievalism. Within this topic, Dr. Zoltán Kelemen will help us to understand what this theory stands for and how it is interpreted in the international environment. Dr. Zoltán Kelemen obtained his PhD degree at Corvinus University of Budapest. Welcome, Zoltán Kelemen, at the IDSA podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
One of your main focus areas is medieval history, and there is a certain theory in which this interlinks with modern international relations and politics, neo-medievalism. Could you tell us what this theory's main points are?
This theory essentially argues that the current international system resembles more the medieval one than the modern one in some respects. For instance, these scholars argue that there are certain actors above the states and below the states, similarly to the medieval international system, where, as I think you all know, there were some actors above kingdoms and also below them. For instance, the Pope, the papacy, and the Holy Roman Empire was in general above the states in terms of authority. And there were some actors like city-states, margraviates, principalities below the level of kingdoms. And what we see today structurally resembles this setup, because you have international organizations and multinational companies above the states, and you have actors like NGOs below or within the states. And these actors, similarly to the medieval constellation, erode or undermine the sovereignty of states. So in that sense, given this array, this wide array of actors in international relations and in the international system, we can think of a neo-medieval system, a system that structurally is similar to the medieval one and that does not resemble terribly the modern international system, the modern Westphalian international system, which was characterized by the states as the exclusive actors of international relations. So this is what we mean by the neo-medieval understanding of international relations.
The theory also states that there are many factors that could challenge the authority of states, and nowadays there is another problem. At least in the European Union, the implementation of the rule of law. Could this be seen as something incompatible with this theory?
The implementation of the rule of law, I think, is something that the European Union has stood for the past decades, since it has been around in international relations. And given the fact that the rule of law has its roots in antiquity and also in the medieval era, it could be thought of as a primary feature of European civilization, of European legal thinking. So in that sense, if a European entity tries to make sure that its member states abide by the rule of law and try to guarantee the existence of the rule of law, I think that is sort of natural, but it is quite clear now by the 2010s, late 2010s and the early 2020s, that the European Union faces certain problems in this sphere, given the fact that the European Union could enforce the guarantees of the rule of law until certain states were only candidates to become later member states of this union. But once they became member states, this project became much more difficult. So while in the 1990s we had the Copenhagen criteria, which try to ensure that the candidate countries abide by certain rules and regulations, now the European Union faces much greater challenges when it tries to act in a similar way vis-a-vis its own member states, like Hungary or Poland. So in a way, I wouldn't say that this runs counter to European history, European legal history, but it could even be thought of as a new medieval attempt in a way, because this attempt is being organized at the level of the European Union rather than within the constitutions of the individual member states.
In medieval times, global or large regional organizations like the EU or the UN didn't exist. Do you think this shift towards a neo-medieval arrangement could endanger these institutions?
I don't think so, on the contrary. In fact, neo-medievalism claims that there are certain important organizations above the level of the states. So in that sense, the existence of the European Union or the United Nations, which are often classified as international organizations, justify the claim of neo-medievalism that we are in a new international system in which there are important actors other than the states, which sometimes also curb the sovereignty of these states. And this is something we can clearly experience in the case of the European Union. And also, if you look at the Middle Ages, the medieval times, you can notice that there were transnational organizations that were important. You could think of the medieval church as a transnational organization. So in a way, the EU and the UN are the very examples based on which some scholars claim that we have already entered the period of neo-medievalism, of the neo-medieval international system.
In your thesis, you have mentioned about the European Union that there are many challenges that can prove the realness of neo-medievalism. What do you think? What are those challenges currently and in the future that the EU will face?
Well, I think when it comes to the concept of neo-medievalism, then we could argue that the European Union faces a challenge of legitimacy. Some called this challenge before the democratic deficit. So when you look at the constitutional structure of the EU, you can realize that the European Union does not really have the separation of powers. Some claim it lacks democratic legitimacy. And then some scholars argue this is so because the European Union is not a state and therefore it does not have to be democratic. However, when you look at this question from the perspective of neo-medievalism, you can say that the reason why the European Union does not fully function in a democratic way is because the Europeans do not have a demos. The Europeans do not speak one single language. They do not have a common language, although English aspires to be one, but it still is not a common language. And without a common language, it is very difficult to form a common political society. There is an Italian scholar called Gian Domenico Maione who claims that the European society is rather primitive compared to the society of the member states. It is at a rather primitive stage of development. You can only compare the whole of Europe, the whole of the European society, to, say, the European society, the society of medieval France, where people did not really understand each other. The people living in Bretagne and the people living in Provence and in Normandy spoke different languages. They did not really have a common demos in medieval France. So if you want to compare the EU to something in historical perspective, you could compare it to a medieval state where there is a lack of common language, a lack of demos, and also therefore a lack of a common European society. And without these, it is very difficult to build a democratic institution. And some other scholars, like Mario Tello, for instance, argue that therefore the European Union, when you look at its constitution, does not resemble a modern liberal democracy, but rather a pre-modern mixed constitution.
What is a mixed constitution?
The mixed constitution is actually an Aristotelian idea that stems from antiquity, but which was very popular during the Middle Ages. Under the umbrella of the mixed constitution narrative, scholars are writing about the ideal regime. And they believe that if people or political entities mix various forms of government, like monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy, then we might find the ideal regime. These scholars believe that there are actually three good and three bad forms of government. The three good ones were monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy, and the bad ones were tyranny, oligarchy, and bad democracy, which was essentially the tyranny of the majority. So if we use some elements of these six forms of government and if we mix them, then we might find the perfect regime. And as you perhaps also know from your historical studies, monarchy was labeled as the rule of the one, aristocracy was labeled as the rule of the few, and democracy was labeled as the rule of the many. And if you try to understand the setup of the European Union, this logic seems more helpful than the functional approach of the separation of powers, which claims that there is a legislative and executive and the judicial power which should be separated. If you look at the main institutions of the European Union, you will notice that the Commission essentially stands for one thing, the whole of the Union, while the Council stands for the few, 27 member states, and the European Parliament stands for, as a democratic element, stands for the many, the people, the citizens of the European Union. So some scholars of political science claim that the Constitution of the European Union in this sense resemble a medieval, a pre-modern mixed constitution rather than a modern liberal democracy. This is what I meant by the mixed constitution.
Let's leave the EU for a moment and look at our globe as a whole. Some experts say that neo-medievalism today is also a political tool used for changing the world order. Do you think the traditional uni-, bi- or multipolar system could ever fully be replaced in the wake of these attempts?
I don't really know if these attempts are really aimed at changing the uni-, bi- or the multipolar order of international relations. I think what I can notice is that within states there are certain attempts to use some of the findings of neo-medievalism when it comes to the justification of the erosion of liberal democracy, the erosion of the checks and balances. So for instance, populist or illiberal leaders tend to emphasize that now that we have international organizations and multinational companies and NGOs that limit the sovereignty of the nation states, we do not need internal limits of power, internal limits of political power anymore. Because as you perhaps also know, during the Enlightenment, the internal limits of political authority, like the separation of powers and protection of the minorities, when these were introduced, they were trying to counterbalance the fact that the external constraints, like the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire, ceased to exist. And they wanted to replace that with something. And therefore, they came up with the internalization of limits of constraints of political authority. But now that again we have external limits of political authority, these solutions of liberal democracy become redundant again. This is a narrative by populist illiberal leaders that to a certain extent rhymes with what neo-medievalism has to say.
If neo-medievalism has a global role, then one question might arise. What about the UN? Where can we find the UN, if we can, in this ideological context?
The United Nations seems to have an outstanding or an influential role in most of the narratives on neo-medievalism. Many scholars claim that the United Nations, in a way, replaces the ideological role of the papacy in the medieval international system, or in the neo-medieval one, to be more precise. Because the United Nations has a certain soft power. The United Nations lacks hard power. And this was the case of the Roman Catholic Church in the Middle Ages. They had a certain type of soft power, a kind of spiritual authority. And even though the United Nations today does not have spiritual authority, quite obviously, it still is important to see that, for instance, its human right regime in its ideological basis or in its theoretical basis is akin to the so-called natural rights movement, which was born and developed mostly on the bosom of the Catholic Church. So in a way, since human rights of which the major representative in the world is the UN, is closely linked to natural rights, which is essentially linked or associated with the Roman Catholic Church, there are scholars who claim that the role of the UN in the neo-medieval international system is essentially universal and in that sense resembles the role of the papacy. So in a way, we can find a place for the UN in such an understanding of international relations.
Historians think that these days there is an increase in interest in Middle Ages. One of the reasons they mention is its common appearance in popular culture, like in movies and computer games. Some countries also build their images on these times, like Iceland. Do you think Middle Ages as a whole could be used as a soft power tool?
The Middle Ages as a whole definitely appears now in popular culture almost everywhere. If you look at really high artistic attempts, or if you look at pop cultural products like the Game of Thrones, you will notice that it really is everywhere. And this emergence or resuscitation of the Middle Ages was noticed already as early as the 1970s. In the 1970s, there was an Italian scholar called Umberto Eco, and he claimed that we are already in the new Middle Ages from a cultural perspective. And he thought so because by that time, the role of television was emphasizing the visual impulses. Visual impulses became more important than literacy, in a way, according to Umberto Eco. And therefore, already in the 1970s, there was a situation in which the oral and the visual culture became just as important as it used to be earlier on during the Middle Ages, when rose windows and frescoes and oral communication were the major tools of storytelling. And now, since the 1970s, with the rise of television, with the rise of visual culture, and especially in the era of the internet, with YouTube, with other similar platforms, visual and oral communication again seem to be more influential than written communication and literacy. And since the basis of modern democracy was essentially written communication and deep debates about the nature of certain political questions, and these were mostly carried out in a written form, it can easily be thought of, neo-medievalism can be thought of as a symptom of the crisis of democracy, where visuality and oral communication are again more important than the more precise written form of communication and debates. So in a way, the rise of and the relevance of the Middle Ages appear both at the level of pop culture, but also in the general way we consume information and we consume news and we try to understand the world.
Let's go back to our current world with its upcoming difficulties. If we take a look deeply at the actions of our current world, we can clearly state that the power of data and information have changed the way we approach international relations. Because of having plenty of information, it is a major power. So, how can neo-medievalism deal with this hardship?
Well, in general, I think the fact that the way we spread information these days does not resemble the 20th century anymore, because we do not have those editorials that define the news, where facts are checked. The way we communicate today, the way news are spread today, resembles more a gossipy medieval village than the 20th century, when you had major newspapers, influential editors who were fact-checking whatever was written down. Now, anyone can create their own understanding and their own vision of reality. And therefore, there is this incredibly strong flow of misinformation, of fake news, of false conceptions. And checking these becomes almost impossible given the amount of such information flooding the world. So in a way, if you look at the structure of the flow of information and the scarcity of fact-checking once it comes to the distribution of such information, we could again clearly argue that it resembles more something pre-modern than the system of the modern press. And again, this could be closely linked to the topic that we have just discussed when we were talking about the previous question, that if images and oral communication replaces written communication, then checking information becomes much more tricky and much more difficult.
Throughout our whole discussion, we mentioned global patterns, but mostly focused on Europe. However, international relations is a global science, so let's end our discussion with the regions we haven't mentioned yet: Africa, South America, and Asia. Their Middle Ages highly differ from what it was in Europe, so the European pattern might be particularly foreign for them. Does the theory apply to these parts of the world at all, and what will be the implications there?
This is a very good question. It is true that if you look at countries like China or India, they have very little to do with the European understanding of the Middle Ages. However, neo-medievalism does not claim that the medieval times will return. It only tries to develop an argument that what we see today in the world in a structural sense, what we see today in the international system today, in a structural sense, resembles the Middle Ages, the European Middle Ages, where kingdoms were not the exclusive actors of diplomacy, where there were more influential actors above them and some very influential ones below or within them. And if we look at what happens, what is happening in the world globally, then it is easy to justify the claim that no matter where a particular state is situated, they are under the influence of these different types of actors, like the United Nations, like multinational companies, like NGOs. But even you could think of examples like the question of city-states. You might remember from your studies of history that in the Middle Ages, there was a certain clash between the territorial state and the city-states. And there were attempts to understand, for instance, the relations between Hong Kong and China under such a theoretical toolkit or based on such a theoretical approach. So that is something very interesting to think of, the fact that now the world is becoming globalized and is becoming more urbanized. So it is very likely that by the middle of the 21st century, the relevance of cities will be stronger than they are now, and not just in the West, but primarily in those parts of the world that are being developed, industrialized right now, where there is a very strong emancipation of the society. You, I think, are familiar with the fact that one of the countries of the world where urbanization has been most rampant over the past decades is China. And since urbanization itself is a very important feature and a very important part of the neo-medieval narrative, we cannot really exclude any part of the world from this approach of international relations. So in a way, even though the rest of the world, other parts of the world, were not experiencing the European type of the Middle Ages, the very structure of the international system today might help them end up in a situation that is, in a way, similar to the Middle Ages.
Today we have discussed with Dr. Zoltán Kelemen about the system of medievalism and how it could change the current international system. I was Dora Tóth, and my co-host was Petra Szijjártó. Thank you for listening.